honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Coming in on Final Approach with decorated Navy pilot Jim Lloyd of Placitas, New Mexico. If you missed the first part of his story last week, you can pick up that podcast at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find a conversation with one of the men who rescued Jim in the dark behind enemy lines 50 years ago, Harry Zinser.
And you shared with me before we started this interview that the reason you're willing to talk about this is because you want to honor those guys who risked their lives to save yours. And it sounds like, you tell me, but it sounds like there was a almost an overwhelming, humbling emotion that you felt when you realized how many resources were devoted to your rescue.
Yeah, absolutely, I did. I couldn't believe it. In fact, my comment was, I cannot believe the Navy's one for all for one. And It really got to me. I still have message traffic from the different ships and commands that were supplying, if nothing else, just support or whatever. It was all part of the 7th Fleet. And I thought, I never bought another drink again in the Philippines. I was told I was the poster child of morale building, just my presence, by people that, just about the whole 7th Fleet knew what I looked like, even though I didn't know them. But I'd be in the Philippines or whatever for a little R&R, that they would see me. And I was told by this, by our commander, our group commander, sometime later, people would look at you, see you there, having a good time, doing whatever, and be reminded the Navy will do anything that's possible to get you out. It's even 50 years today, I get emotional thinking about how wonderful and dedicated the Navy was for me.
And you hinted at that those 5.5 months that followed that life-changing night weren't exactly a cakewalk. Was there ever a time where, even for a moment, maybe you questioned that decision to stay?
Not so much. Yeah, I guess there was one I questioned. One of the first flights, I think it was the first flight back, I was with a squadron mate, Bill Moyer. We were over North Vietnam the daytime, about where I went down, and I remember thinking to myself, what am I doing here? I prayed to God if I ever got out of here, I'd go home. I wouldn't. And here I am again, and Bill's wife is 3 days stateside overdue, and he has no business here. And just then, he took a hit, and the A-7 had 5 spars that held the wing on, and the main fuel tank was in the wing, and he went right through that, took 3 spars out, and about a 18-inch diameter hole through the fuel tank. And he was spiraling down with his big white plume of fuel going out. I kicked off my bombs and went after him. We got back. He was able to get the plane under control. We got over the beach, back over water, and I called for a tanker, and he was able to plug in and air-to-air plug in and fly with most of the fuel going out the hole, but enough to keep the engine spooling. And this tanker made a low pass on the ship and pulled out, and he pulled out and landed, and then I came around and landed next to him, and I walked up to shake his hand, and I realized he was flying Alpha Charlie 410. It was, we had our names on our planes. We didn't always fly them, obviously. We just flew whatever's available. But it happened to be the one with my name on it, Lieutenant Jim Lloyd Zeke. And here it was just shot out. But the first day I'm back over the north, I thought, you know, somebody's trying to tell me something, and I'm not doing a good job of paying attention. But so there were some exciting times. And when I hear the warble of a fan song, it would get me really excited. You know, your natural instincts is to run from it. Of course, you're going 500 knots, and the missile's doing 3,000. You're not going to get very far before you're gone. You know, I had to fight those natural fears. Flying the airplane again, it was just a piece of cake for me. I didn't have any fears of it or whatever, because my thinking was the dying breath of that airplane, it kicked me out safely.
And you mentioned a few times, that was another miracle, that was another miracle, that was another miracle. Have you inventoried them? Have you made a count of all the little twists and turns that if they had gone just a little differently, you wouldn't be here?
No, I guess not specifically. I'd say there's about 6 or 8 of them that were really hot, really made a difference. Probably the most difficult of all of them, the two of them. Going back for the radio, I had no choice. I mean, the rescue would have been over with if I didn't. So that probably wasn't as, it was scary, and what ifs was very underlined. But the one that was really the hardest, probably of all of them, was rolling over to grab the gun in face of potential being shot. knowing the guy was standing there. When it turned out, it wasn't. But I could have just laid there and waited. They showed up. That was probably the most difficult. The other ones were difficult, but you know, you do what you have to do. And as the evening went on into the night, into the early morning hours, I started feeling like, you know, this is being pieced together. This is happening. I may get out of this. So it wasn't that I would take chances, but I would be probably more willing to make difficult situations, knowing that I'd made some difficult ones already and made it through.
And again, I want to be careful not to put thoughts in your head and words in your mouth, but one of the things that struck me as I'm listening to all this, and you were very intent on not becoming a prisoner of war because you knew what that would likely mean, and you, in your case, where you were, you probably wouldn't have survived that. But I'm thinking of a lot of the prisoners of war that I've interviewed over the years, and quite a few of them here in New Mexico, including guys that survived the Bataan Death March, very similar circumstances to what you went through. And what always struck me was the perspective they had in life after their ordeal. They never took anything for granted, and some of the challenges they encountered really paled in comparison with what they'd ever been through. Do you see an impact of what you went through that night on how you've lived the 50 years since?
I think so. You know, something as simple as bending a nail and getting mad at it and then realizing that there was one time in your life you had a broken neck in the rice paddies with a gun in your back 150 miles north of the DMZ, and now you're complaining about a bent nail. You know, you have to put things in perspective. And I think about it a lot. But I got some positive things out of it. There's two that really stood out and still stands out and will always stand out. One, when I see the ocean, going feet wet, you know you're safe, at least it's harder for the enemy to get you if you hit the water, and the Navy has a better chance of getting you. So after every mission, when you look at it, first it starts out as a silver line off the horizon, and it seemed forever to get closer and closer, even though you're going pretty fast. And when you make it over there and call the ship and say your feet wet, it's just a tremendous feeling. And when I see the ocean, I get this tremendous sense of calm and safetiness. And the other one is the night. I told my wife, the night is your ally. You know, yeah, you always feel you can't see certain things. Well, whatever you're afraid of can't see you either. I told my two boys when they were little and afraid of the night, I said, the night is your ally. I feel very much at peace and safe in the night as well.
And you mentioned your two boys. I just have to ask, did they already exist when you were going through this, or were they born later?
They were born after I got out of the Navy. Yeah, no, I didn't have kids. I was married. But, you know, my twin brother has four sons. I have two. My sister has a boy and a girl. And none of them went in the military. Of course, the draft became, you know, a thing of the past long before they were eligible. And I often wonder why they didn't want to go in. And then, of course, I think about, well, both their dad and their uncle, you know, what they went through. Why would I want to take a chance when I don't have to? So I understand.
Yeah, they wouldn't be here if you didn't survive all of that. And, you know, we've focused so much of this on just a few hours that you endured, but those few hours also gave you some friends for life. Can you help us understand what the connection or bond that you've developed with your rescuers has been?
Yes, you know, I don't see them as much as I wanted to. But we get together, it's really, really, really nice. And every August 6th, I try to call them and talk to them. Any chance I get, I talk about them, you know, by name. Sadly, the two gunners in the back are deceased, and the rest of us are getting older. But I got really warm feelings, and we talk like we've been friends for half a century, even though we don't see each other all the time. But when we get together, it's like we live right next door to each other. It's really nice. And there's other friends in that too, and not just the ones around my rescue, but just people I knew in the Navy. There's a bonding in the military that really can't compare to anything in the civilian life. Things that come the closest to it are the first responders, whether they're fire, police, medical, or whatever. But it's a warm feeling. I did not join the military with even the thought of I'm joining to become a veteran, but it's one of my most prized possessions.
Well, that may be the answer to a question I'm sure to ask you in a minute here, but I'm just also curious to know, I'm sure our listeners are, I mean, this was 50 years ago. You haven't been sitting around doing nothing for 50 years. You worked for the Forest Service for a long time?
Well, I got out on GI Bill and got my master's degree, and then I started out with the Bureau of Land Management, Northern Nevada, and then I transferred from there after a few years to Montana for nine years, and was there as a fishery biologist for one of the best fisheries in the country of three states. And then I decided I wanted to move up in the outfit a little more than, even though I love that job. And so I moved to Atlanta and became a program manager for the southeastern United States for the Forest Service. Was there for a few years, then moved to Washington, D.C. and ran the fishery program for the Forest Service, and then came out to Albuquerque, 31 years ago, and was the director of Fish and Wildlife for the Southwestern National Forest, and then retired, and I've been retired 21 years.
And in your retirement, you've had a little fun, too. In fact, some of our listeners may have seen you on the silver screen. You didn't think I was going to ask you about that one, did you?
No, I did not. Well, because you did, my wife, who she's got the looks in the family, over the last few years, she got us into it to do backgrounds for the booming movie business here in the Albuquerque area. It's a lot of fun. You don't know what you're going to be. And dressing up, particularly for Westerns and time era type of programs, are to me the most enjoyable, because you actually do go back into those times mentally, because they're so realistic on detail about how you look, how the sets are set and whatever. So I've been anywhere from a cowboy in the Westerns, businessman on a train that's blown up in the Westerns, and that kind of a gunman in the Westerns, to I was a four-star general and Air Force general in the second Independence Day until the aliens got me. And and then I got roped into being an old man in a rest home, which I didn't appreciate my wife getting me into it. In fact, when she saw me on the sets, we came in at different times, and I'm in these old, god-awful clothes, you know, plaids and checks and slippers and stuff. And one of the, and she was dressed up as a news lady in a suit, and she was at a different time, and she's standing there talking to some of our friends, and one of them said, is that Jim over there? She looks at him and says, no, he's at home. She wouldn't even admit it. So anyway, it's been fun, really fun. And you meet some tremendous actors.
Well, so just for people's points of reference, you mentioned the second Independence Day. What are some of those other credits? So this was not the first Independence Day where they blow up the White House. This is the sequel. But the aliens did what the North Vietnamese could not, and they took you out, huh?
Yeah, they came in through the roof of the building we were in, and that was it. You know, we were all kind of doomed at that point. I was with Patrick St. Esprit. He was my boss in the movie. He was a Secretary of Defense, and I really enjoyed visiting with him. And anyway, he was the first to go. The alien literally picked him up and destroyed him. And it was an assumption that we were all dead, and that was it. So. Mm-hmm. But it's fun. I've been in about almost 50.
What are some of the other projects maybe that we'd recognize the name of them?
Okay, Longmire. Now we're in and out of The Cleaning Lady. But Better Call Saul. There's a lot of them that the titles have changed. They have a working title, and that's the only ones I'm familiar with, so I don't think the audience would know if they saw them. Mm-hmm. But as I mentioned, you meet some phenomenal actors and actors. Morgan Freeman's phenomenal. Lou Diamond Phillips, very personable. You know, it's just fun. It's a dimension of the movie business I never even knew what it would be like. And it's even better than I thought.
And I have to ask, I mean, at any point, have any of those people ever been made aware of what you went through? Because there's a few hours of your life that would make a pretty compelling movie.
No, you know, not the actors and stuff. Some of the background, we have spent a lot of time together just waiting for our turns and stuff and play cards and stuff, eat meals and whatever. And there's a few of them that are ex-military that we got in discussions and they know about it. But I don't know of anybody beyond that I've shared it with. You know, you're pretty busy on the set anyway, so.
Well, and, you know, this has been 50 years, so you're not that 27-year-old anymore, and we can't ask your twin brother to play you because he's not 27 anymore either. If you had to choose one of those Hollywood actors to portray you in the story of August 6, 1972, who do you think you'd go with?
Oh, geez, that's a good question, because if I say somebody funny, you know, it would make me look really good. And if I said somebody that was pretty impressive, it looked like I'm bragging. But, you know, it's hard to say. I never, ever gave that a thought. They probably have the same actors who both of us. Oh, boy. That's a good question. I have to think about that one.
Well, who knows? It may happen sometime. And people can, if they want to, go online. And on YouTube, there's a documentary where your ordeal from 50 years ago is captured. What's that called?
Okay, that came out as a result of this presentation that I did for the Navy's, I was a guest speaker, one of the guest speakers at last year's Tailhook in Reno. It's the first one I've ever been to, where all the pilots of the different eras get together and in a convention, and they have speakers and so forth, and I told my story there. And they were making a documentary on Navy pilots from World War II forward, and there's 14 of us. They had to cut me about half what I said. They did a good job. There's a lot of computerization in it. You'll see me when I was 50 years younger. And I'm narrating myself. And I was really honored for that, because there is some tremendous stories that I was just proud, honored to be included in as part of that. But it's called Legends of Carrier Aviation on YouTube.
Well, I guess if you're a legend, maybe you can play that old guy in the retirement home, huh?
Well, maybe so. You know, it's hard to say. But I'm 77. I really have a hard time passing as a kid anymore. In fact, that's one of the things with being background. I tell people it might be a shock to you, but I can't play those roles as a high school kid anymore.
Well, I'm sure there's so much more we could talk about, but there's something I don't want to forget to say, and that's thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us an unbelievable story that I'm sure has given a lot of people perspective today. Is there anything else that you think it's important to understand that maybe what you went through taught you?
Well, I would say for anybody, believe in yourself. You'd be amazed at what you could do. And if it's an overwhelming obstacle ahead of you, just remember, if you eat an elephant, you eat an elephant a bite at a time. You just one step at a time to get through it. Believe in yourself. You could, if you really want to do something, you can.
And you made reference something earlier that gives you pride. So that's a question I always like to ask. And most of the guys I talk to are much older than you, and they have a little more to look back on. But you've had 77 action-packed years here. When you take stock of all that, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I look back. It's been a great ride, and I'm real proud of the opportunities I was able to do this, because I think our generation probably lived in the best place and the best time in the history of mankind, and given a lot of opportunities, and I really appreciate all that. But when I look back, it's an unconscious decision. It's those years in the military that really stand out, with the good and the bad. I mean, you learn who you are, you test your mettle. Thankfully, not everybody has that opportunity to do that, and you don't want to go through some life-threatening things just to see who you are. But I was happy of my ability, just glad I was had the ability to do what I had to do when the chips were down. And I attribute to the large majority of that is through the training that was given to me.
And one last question, then if you have anything else to add, feel free. But I'm just looking at the wall next to us here in your office, and I see a picture of a young Navy pilot. There's some A7 artwork there. There's a reunion of your squadron where everybody signed the sheet. All of your medals are there, and there's a lot of decorations. There's different photos, including from August 6th of 1972 when you got back to the ship after that rescue. I'm just wondering, with all the stuff on that wall there, a saber up there too, is there one thing on there that is most meaningful to you that when you stop and take stock of it, those emotions are really stirred?
Well, there's three. I'm going to say one is a document that was given to me by a retired Navy chief from Hawaii. I didn't know him. He was a gunner on one of the helicopters way back then. And he had a piece of paper. It was handed to him on the Midway. It was handwritten of coordinates where they thought I was and whatever, because he was going on one of the helicopters to my rescue. And in 2005, through a miracle, he found me. He wrote a story on that's on the wall, and the paper is framed. It's a important part of my rescue. Another one was just given to me by a retired Navy captain just on August 6th of this year, the party my wife had for me in celebration of it. His wife, I guess it's an embroidered or anyway, handmade. It says, Lieutenant Jim Lloyd, August 6th, 1972. Beeper, beeper, come up voice. And that was what I heard on the radio coming back in that A6 that made me decide to stay. And then the third thing that it really gets to me is that, Paul, you can't read it from here, but that's that gold plaque up there, that gold frame deal. It's my name tag on my flight gear, my name, rank, and the wings. And it's on Velcro, so you can take it off if you have to. And it was on my flight suit. And when I got back aboard the Cleveland, and I got my flight suit back, I figured somebody took it because it was gone, and as a souvenir when they did the laundry. And I thought, well, I got more of them. Well, that was in 1972, and in May of 1999, when I gave a talk years later in Pensacola at the Air Museum of my rescue, they had a bunch of the people that were on there and myself, and one of the gunners, he's of course a gray-haired man now, walks up in front of everybody, about 1,500 people in the audience, and hands that to me, and it still had a little mud on it. And he said, "We our tradition is when we pull in the helicopter, as soon as we can, we take your name tag." And he said, "I've had this for all these years." And he said, "We're making an exception. I've given it back to you." And so my wife had it framed, and then the plaque on the bottom says, "Lost, Vinson North, Vietnam, August 6, 1972. Returned, Pensacola, Florida, May of 1997. So those are the three that stand out the most.
And I just have to ask, because you said it still had a little mud on it. How'd that mud smell?
Well, you know, I never got close enough to it to smell it. I just, now that might trigger some emotions that I don't want if I smelled it. But, you know, I've been real fortunate about that. So far, not have a nightmare. So I wouldn't want to do something that might change that. I just want to thank you for this opportunity, because it's another opportunity for me to try to recognize those brave men, officers and men that were there for me 50 years ago, made my life possible. Because, you know, when I got back aboard the Cleveland, I had the sigh of relief that I have my life now, at least for now. It might change down the road, but right for now, I got my life ahead of me. And when I'm 50 years down the road looking back, it's more than that, because that life ahead of me is now specific. It's wives, it's kids, it's my career, the fun I had, the events I had. There are actual things that I never would have had if it wasn't for those people. So thank you for that.
An attitude of gratitude, fitting for the season we're in. That is Jim Lloyd of Placitos, New Mexico. Keep an eye out for him in those movies and TV shows. And don't forget to access the photos and a little video with Jim at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.